An Evening with Dar Jamal. Keynote speaker at the People as the Media Grassroots Independent Media Conference at Palomar College, San Marcos, California, on July 30, 2005. Recorded for independent media by UpstartRadio.com.
Down, I wanted to ask you all to turn off your cell phones. Okay. If I have to describe our speaker tonight with one word, it would be courageous, maybe crazy. Some of you got a chance to hear him earlier today, and Dar spoke earlier about his involvement as an unembedded reporter in Iraq and the experience of doing that. And tonight we're going to hear a much sadder side of the story, which is what he found in Iraq and what we're not hearing about in mainstream media. And just like this conference all day today was about that we have to be the media, I hope that everyone who sees this tonight will go out and tell people what's really happening. And when you get people who say, oh, we have to stay in Iraq now because it'll be chaos without us, just remember what you see tonight. Okay? Dar Jamal.
Well, thanks again. And I asked her actually to say crazy instead of courageous, but she's a lot more diplomatic than I am. Thanks again to everyone that helped organize this. Is that going to work? And I wish I had been here for more of the conference than just the tail end of it, because obviously a really good day for independent media here. This conference is really, really important stuff. And I also, you know, most of all, thank everyone for coming. It's good to see that people are staying tuned to Iraq, because things will continue to degrade there the longer that our government insists on staying there. I'm going to talk tonight. First, I'm going to give you the presentation that I gave to the World Tribunal on Iraq, the culminating session in Istanbul, Turkey. For those who don't know, which is perhaps no fault of your own, since the world tribunals have been effectively censored from corporate media in this country from the very beginning. The World Tribunal is essentially an ongoing series of meetings that have took place around the world for the duration of the occupation. There were 20 different world tribunals throughout the globe, one even in New York City, and it's essentially a people's movement to bring the truth of what's happening in Iraq, all the violations of international law, bring this to light, present it to the people so that the evidence is there. And from every aspect of the invasion and occupation that you can think of, from the use of uranium munitions and other illegal weapons, to violations of international law, to the failures of the UN, to the cultural destruction that's taking place and has taken place in Iraq, really just about anything you can think of has been covered. And so the culminating session that occurred at the end of June in Istanbul really took bits from every single one of the tribunals that had taken place before it. And it's a huge movement, and it got really incredible press. In Turkey, for example, it was headline news while it was going on. All of their national television stations and their big newspapers covered it, as did so many other countries around the world. There were 130 journalists there from around the world. And, of course, the big glaring omission was folks from, for example, CNN or NBC or CBS, which really isn't a big surprise when we look at how the whole invasion has been covered. So I was asked to show up and provide testimony about the situation of torture in Iraq, as well as look at the state of the healthcare system in Iraq under occupation, and then provide an overview of the situation on the ground there today, a little bit over 2 years into the occupation. So that's what I'm going to present to you tonight, with photos And then I also have a film made by a colleague of mine from Santa Barbara, Mark Manning, who's an independent filmmaker, and he's the only Western non-embedded filmmaker who's gone into Fallujah since the November siege. And this is a sample of his footage, and it's soon to be available to the public, and it will be distributed soon. And he's also working on a longer documentary of the same. But this will give you a good idea of what the situation is in Fallujah now. So to start with my testimony, in May of 2004, I interviewed a man who had just been released from Abu Ghraib. Like so many I interviewed from various U.S. military detention facilities who'd been tortured horrifically, he still managed to maintain his sense of humor. He began laughing when telling me how CIA agents made him beat other prisoners. He laughed, he said, because he had been beaten himself prior to this and was so tired that all he could do to beat other detained Iraqis was lift his arm and let it drop on the other men. Later, he laughed again as he told me what else had been done to him when he said, "The Americans brought electricity to my ass before they brought it to my house." But this testimony is not about the indomitable spirit of the Iraqi people. About the dignity and strength of Iraqis, we need no testimony. This testimony is about ongoing violations of international law being committed by the occupiers of Iraq on a daily basis in regards to rampant torture, the neglect and obstruction of the healthcare sector, and the ongoing failure to allow Iraqis to reconstruct their infrastructure. To discuss torture, there are so many stories I could use here, but I'll use two examples indicative of scores of others I documented in my time in Iraq. Ali Abbas lives in the Al-Amariya district of Baghdad and worked in civil administration. So many of his neighbors were detained that friends urged him to go to the nearby U.S. base to try and get answers for why so many innocent people were detained. He went three times. On the fourth time, he was detained himself. Within 2 days, he was transferred from the military base to Abu Ghraib, where he was held over 3 months without charges before being released. "The minute I got there, the suffering began," said Abbas about his interrogator. "I asked him for water, and he said after the investigation I would get some. He accused me of so many things and asked me so many questions. Among them, he said I hated Christians." He was forced to strip naked shortly after arriving and remained that way for most of his stay in the prison. "They made us lay on top of each other naked as if it was sex and beat us with a broom," he said. In addition to being beaten on their genitals, detainees were also denied water and food for extended periods of time, then were forced to watch as their food was thrown in the trash. Treatment also included having a loaded gun held to his head to prevent him from crying out in pain as his hand ties were tightened. "My hands were enlarged because there was no blood because they cuffed them so tight," he told me. "My head was covered with a sack, and they fastened my right hand to a pole with handcuffs. They made me stand on my toes to clip me to it." Abbas said soldiers doused him in cold water while holding him under a fan, and oftentimes, quote, "They put on a loudspeaker, put the speakers on my ears, and said, 'Shut up, fuck, fuck, fuck.'" In this manner, Abbas's interrogators routinely deprived him of sleep. Abbas said that at one point, quote, "Two men came, one a foreigner and one a translator. He asked me who I was. I said, 'I am a human being.' They told me, 'We are going to cut your head off and send you to hell. We will take you to Guantanamo.' A female soldier told him, 'Our aim is to put you in hell so you will tell the truth. These are the orders we have from our superiors, to turn your lives into hell.'" Abbas added, "They shit on us, used dogs against us, used electricity, and starved us." He told me, "Saddam Hussein used to have people like those who tortured us. Why do they put Saddam into trial, but they do not put the Americans to trial?" But unlike Saddam Hussein, the U.S. interrogators also desecrated Islam as part of their humiliation. Abbas was made to fast during the first day of Eid, the breaking of the fast of Ramadan, which is haram, forbidden. Sometimes at night, when he would read his Quran, Abbas had to hold it in the hallway for light. Soldiers would walk by and kick the holy Quran, and sometimes they would try to piss on it or wipe shit on it, he said. Abbas did not feel this was the work of a few individual soldiers. Quote, This was organized. It wasn't just individuals. And every one of the troops in Abu Ghraib was responsible for it. Accounts by human rights groups support this. According to an April 2005 Human Rights Watch report, Abu Ghraib was only the tip of the iceberg. It's now clear that abuse of detainees has happened all over, from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay to a lot of third country dungeons where the U.S. has sent prisoners, and probably quite a few other places we don't even know about. The report adds, harsh and coercive interrogation techniques, such as subjecting detainees to painful stress positions and extended sleep deprivation, have been routinely used in detention centers throughout Iraq. An ICRC report concluded that in military intelligence sections of Abu Ghraib, methods of physical and psychological coercion used by the interrogators appeared to be part of the standard operating procedures by military intelligence personnel to obtain confessions and extract information. Amnesty International has also released similar findings. Other human rights groups report that U.S. military doctors, nurses, and medics have been complicit in torture and other illegal procedures, such as those administered to Sadiq Zoman. 55-year-old Zoman, detained from his home in Kirkuk in a raid by U.S. soldiers that produced no weapons, was taken to a police office in Kirkuk to the Kirkuk Airport Detention Center, the Tikrit Airport Detention Center, and finally to the 28th Combat Support Hospital, where he was treated by Dr. Michael Hodges, a lieutenant colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Hodges' medical report listed Zoman's primary condition as hypoxic brain injury, brain damage caused by lack of oxygen. With persistent vegetative state, myocardial infarction, heart attack, and heat stroke. After 1 month in custody, Zoman was dropped off in a coma at the General Hospital in Tikrit by U.S. soldiers. Zoman's last name was listed as his first name on the report, despite the fact that all of his identification papers were taken during the raid on his home. Because of this, it took his desperate family weeks to locate him in the hospital. Hodges' medical report did not mention the fact that the back of Zoman's head was bashed in, nor that he had electrical burn marks on the bottoms of his feet and genitals, or why he had lash marks across his back and chest. Today, he lies in bed still in a coma, and there has been no compensation provided to his now impoverished family for what was done to Sadiq Zoman. Another aspect I shall discuss is the catastrophic situation of the health system in Iraq. I've recently released a report on the condition of Iraq's hospitals under occupation. Although the Iraq Ministry of Health has supposedly gained its sovereignty and received promises of over $1 billion of U.S. funding, hospitals in Iraq continue to face ongoing medicine, equipment, and staffing shortages under the U.S.-led occupation. During the 1990s, medical supplies and equipment were constantly in short supply because of the sanctions against Iraq. The war and occupation brought promises of relief from effects of the sanctions, yet hospitals have had little chance to recover and resupply. Instead, the occupation has closely resembled a low-grade war since its inception. In addition, allocation of resources by occupation authorities has been dismal. Thus, throughout Baghdad, there are ongoing shortages of functional equipment and medicines of even the most basic items, such as analgesics, antibiotics, anesthetics, and insulin. Surgical items and even basic supplies like rubber gloves, gauze, and medical tape are running out. In April of 2004, an ICRC report stated that hospitals in Iraq are overwhelmed with new patients, short of medicine and supplies, and lack both adequate electricity and water, with ongoing bloodshed stretching the hospital's already meager resources to the limit. Ample testimony from medical practitioners confirms this crisis. A general practitioner at the prosthetics workshop at Al-Kina Hospital in Baghdad, Dr. Thamiz Aziz Abdul Rahman, said, 11 months ago, we submitted an emergency order for prosthetic materials to the Ministry of Health, and still we have nothing. After a pause, he added, this is worse than even during the sanctions. Dr. Qasim Al-Nuaisri, the chief manager of Shuadar General Hospital, one of the two hospitals in the sprawling slum area of Sadr City, Baghdad, and home to 3 million people, added that they too faced a shortage of most supplies, and most critically of ambulances. But for his hospital, the lack of potable water was the major problem. Of course, we have typhoid, cholera, kidney stones, but we now even have the very rare hepatitis type E, and it has become common in our area, said Al-Nuaisri, adding that they never faced these problems prior to the invasion of 2003. Shuadar Hospital needs at least 2,000 liters of water per day to function with basic sterilization practices. According to Dr. Al-Nuaisri, they receive 15% of this amount. The rest of the water is contaminated and causing problems, as are the electricity cuts, added Al-Nuaisri. Without electricity, our instruments in the operating room cannot work, and we have no pumps to bring us water. At Fallujah General Hospital, Dr. Ahmed, who asked that only his first name be used because he feared U.S. military reprisals, said of the April 2004 siege that, quote, "The Americans shot out the lights in the front of our hospital. They prevented doctors from reaching the emergency unit at the hospital, and we quickly began to run out of supplies and much-needed medications." He also said that Marines kept the physicians in the residence building several times, intentionally prohibiting them from entering the hospital in order to treat patients. In November, shortly after leveling Nizal Emergency Hospital, U.S. forces entered Fallujah General Hospital, the city's only healthcare facility for trauma victims, detaining employees and patients alike. According to medics on the scene, water and electricity were cut off, ambulances targeted or confiscated by the U.S. military, and surgeons, without exception, kept out of the besieged city. Hospital raids by U.S. military and U.S.-backed Iraqi forces now appear to be standard operating procedure. On the 18th of June, doctors at the main hospital in Bakuba went on strike, saying they were fed up with constant abuse at the hands of aggressive Iraqi police and soldiers. Dr. Mohammed Hazem in Bakuba pleaded for his governor to protect he and his colleagues from, quote, "organized terrorism of the police and army." When wounded Iraqi security forces showed up demanding treatment, Dr. Hussein told one of them he would require an X-ray. The doctor was told to go to hell by the policeman he was treating and was then beaten. The same policeman then ordered another police officer to put a bag over the doctor's head and take him away. Our security guards tried to stop them, telling them I was a doctor, but they didn't listen and beat the security guards too, he said. Then one of them put a gun to my head and threatened me. Similar behavior has been reported during the recent U.S.-Iraqi military operations in Haditha and Al-Qaim. Doctors also recently went on strike at the large Yarmouk Hospital in Baghdad in a very similar incident. Many doctors in Iraq believe that the lack of assistance, if not outright hostility by the U.S. military, coupled with the lack of rebuilding and reconstruction by foreign contractors, has compounded the problems they are facing. The former ambassador of Iraq, Paul Bremer, admitted that U.S.-led coalition spending on the Iraqi health system was inadequate, when he said, "It's not nearly enough to cover the needs in the healthcare field." When asked if his hospital had received assistance from the U.S. military or reconstruction contractors, Dr. Sarmad Rahim, the administrator of chief doctors at Al-Kirk Hospital in Baghdad, said, "Never, ever. Some soldiers came here 5 months ago and asked what we needed. We told them and they never brought us one single needle. We heard that some people from the CPA came here, but they never did anything for us." At Fallujah General Hospital, Dr. Muhammad said there has been virtually no assistance from foreign contractors. And of the U.S. military, he commented, "They send only bombs, not medicine." International aid has been stymied by the horrendous security situation in Iraq. After the UN headquarters was bombed in Baghdad in August 2003, killing 22 people, aid agencies and NGOs either reduced their staffing or pulled out entirely. With senior Iraqi doctors fleeing Iraq en masse for fear of being kidnapped, interns and younger doctors are left to deal with the catastrophic situation. The World Health Organization last year warned of a health emergency in Baghdad, as well as throughout Iraq, if current conditions persist. But despite claims from the Ministry of Health of more drugs, better equipment, and generalized improvement, Doctors on the ground still see, quote, no such improvement. In conclusion, a quick summary of the overall situation on the ground in Iraq is in order. Over 2 years into the illegal occupation, while Iraq sits upon a sea of oil, ongoing gasoline shortages plague Iraqis who sometimes wait 2 days to fill their cars. In a country where a long gas line once meant a one-car wait, Iraqis who are lucky enough to afford it now purchase black market petrol and hope that it is not watered down. Electricity remains in short supply. Most of Iraq, including the northern region, receives on average 3 hours of electricity per day amidst the nearly non-existent reconstruction efforts. Even the better areas of Baghdad receive only 6 to 8 hours per day, forcing those who can afford them to use small generators to run fans and refrigerators in their homes. Of course, this is only for those who've been able to obtain the now rarefied gasoline. The security situation is, needless to say, horrendous, with over 100,000 Iraqis killed thus far and the number of U.S. soldiers killed approaching 2,000. The violence only continues to escalate. Since the new Iraqi so-called government was sworn in this past April, well over 2,000 Iraqis and over 300 U.S. soldiers have died in the violence. These numbers will only continue to escalate as the failed occupation grinds on. As the heavy-handed tactics of the U.S. military persist, the Iraqi resistance continues to grow in its number and lethality. As I mentioned before, potable water remains in short supply. Cholera, typhoid, and other waterborne diseases are rampant, even in parts of the capital city, as lack of reconstruction continues to plague Iraq's infrastructure. Raw sewage is common not just Baghdad, but other cities throughout Iraq. With 70% unemployment, a growing resistance, and an infrastructure in shambles, the future for Iraq remains bleak as long as the failed occupation persists. While the Bush administration continues to disregard calls for a timetable for withdrawal, Iraqis continue to suffer and die with little hope for their future. With each passing day, the catastrophe in Iraq resembles the U.S. debacle in Vietnam more and more. Dr. Wamid Omar Nathmi, a senior political scientist at Baghdad University, told me last winter during an interview, "It will take Iraqis something like a quarter of a century to rebuild their country, to heal their wounds, to reform their society, to bring about some sort of national reconciliation, democracy, and tolerance of each other. But that promise will not begin until the U.S. occupation of Iraq ends." I want now to briefly introduce a film that I'll show. Like I said, it was made by a colleague of mine, Mark Manning, and he's an independent filmmaker from Santa Barbara. And before I get to the film, since it does focus on Fallujah exclusively, I want to give you a brief history of the events that led up to what this film will show, because another convenient tactic employed by the corporate media is framing things in a particular way and certainly not giving adequate history of events and what has caused them. So talking about Fallujah, I would point out that during the invasion of March and April of 2003, there was no fighting in Fallujah. While many people in that city considered themselves to have benefited under Saddam, some of his ex-officers, military people lived there. Most people still considered themselves victims in his opponents. And so there was no fighting there because most people were very, very happy when he was removed from power. But problems began shortly thereafter, about 2 weeks after the fall of Baghdad. In late April 2003, there was an elementary school in the middle of Fallujah that was occupied by U.S. soldiers. So locals held a demonstration outside of that school, and for a couple of reasons. One was for cultural reasons, because in Fallujah, it's a very religiously conservative town, and in the summers in Fallujah and elsewhere around Iraq, it's real common for people to sleep on the rooftops of their homes for coolness. And that's what people did. So they didn't want soldiers on top of the school, which is where they were, as using it as an observation post, and they had snipers there. And they didn't want like the fact that soldiers could look down into their courtyards and see women and children and see people sleeping on the rooftops. And the second reason, and just as important if not more, was that the next day was the day classes were going to begin, and they wanted to be able to have the elementary school for their kids to use. And so they held a demonstration. It was they were unarmed, and soldiers opened fire on them and killed 17 people, and 8 died of wounds. Later, the next day, there was another smaller demonstration with similar results, although not as many people were killed. Hence, the resistance was born in Fallujah, and the military responded by cracking down more, which, of course, created more resistance, and so it goes. Leading up to March 31st, when the 4 security contractors, i.e. mercenaries, were killed and the horrible things done to their bodies. But I should preface that event by saying that the security contractors don't have to operate under the military rules of engagement. They don't have to use the same weapons or ammunition, and they don't. And they are oftentimes used by the military to do the dirty work. And these people had been operating in Fallujah for several months prior to what happened in March. And many people in the city were reporting that these men were going around carrying out assassinations and literally raping and pillaging in the city. So they were attacked when they were, 4 of them were killed when they were traveling through the city in late March. And horrible things were done to their bodies. A crowd, it wasn't the attackers, but a crowd of mostly younger men. You can see it clearly in the photos of about 20 or 30 younger men gathered around and burnt the bodies, cut them up, drug them through the streets, hung some from the bridges, what was left of them. And it was actions that was staunchly denounced also by all of the imams in the city. All of the religious leaders and mosque speakers staunchly denounced this. Of course, that wasn't reported in the mainstream media here. But that essentially set the stage for the first siege of Fallujah in April 2004. The city was surrounded. But I should also point out that the U.S. military had been taking part in trying to win the people of Fallujah over and quell the violence in the city. They were active in ongoing construction projects. They were reconstructing some schools. They were involved in some irrigation projects and small things, definitely only token, but they felt this was the best way to try to win the favor of the people of Fallujah. And even after what happened on March 31st to the contractors, they did not want to siege the city. That order came directly from the White House. And it was against what the commanders of the military in that area wanted to do. So the April siege, the failed siege, came and went for the most part because enough information got out about the brutality and the heavy-handed tactics being used that enough political pressure was exerted, along with the fact that the military basically couldn't push into the city without bombing most of it to the ground, which is what they did in November. So that set the stage for the city was essentially unoccupied then up until November. There were many bombing runs made on the city almost on a daily basis for the 3 months prior to the siege. The November 2nd elections here came and went, and then 6 days later, Iraq was put under martial law, and the siege of that city began. Conclude with telling you the main 3 recommendations reached by the jury of conscience from the World Tribunal, the culminating session of the World Tribunal on Iraq in Turkey. The first recommendation is a full and immediate unconditional withdrawal of all occupation forces from Iraq. The second is full compensation paid to every Iraqi who has suffered the loss of a loved one or damage as a result, it got to me tonight. As the result of the invasion or occupation. And number three, all reconstruction projects reopen for bidding, giving Iraqi companies first preference.
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about this before, but we're going to do a question and answer session, but was there going to be any announcements made or anything like that?
Would you please repeat the question?
Yeah.
For the filmmaker who made that film, he made donations out at the front table. That was for... He made donations out at the front table. That was for counter-recruitment efforts, but this is for to support the filmmaker. What's his name? Michael?
Mark Manning.
Mark Manning. Okay.
Smallest budget. Here's the other.
Yeah, while that's going around, people ask me a lot what they can do to help. And this NGO is the only international NGO I know of that is effectively getting aid into the combat areas in central Iraq, places like Fallujah. And I can personally attest that 100% of funds donated to this NGO will go directly into Iraq. They're a very, very small organization. They're three people, two in the U.S., one in Baghdad. And the way they operate is the two in the U.S. try to publicize and provide support and funding to send into the person in Iraq who goes out, for example, to Fallujah General Hospital and asks them specifically, what do you need? Gets a list, goes back into Baghdad, buys the supplies, and takes them back out. So this is a really, really good way to help, and they definitely need your support. They're trying to get started.
This is
separate, right.
What's the name of the...
This is called, it's internationalpeaceangels.com. That's the name of the NGO, is International Peace Angels.
Check out.
The donation bucket going around is to support Mark Manning, who is the independent filmmaker from Santa Barbara. He's having this film. This is a short film that will be released to the public soon. And maybe if you could go back to my website. I'm going to put my website up here too, because if you can subscribe on my website for free, you'll get all my dispatches. And when this film is available for the public, I'll blast out a notice about it.
What's your website?
My website is my name. It's darjamaliraq.com. That's how you spell my name. And everything I've written about Iraq is there. I've got a couple of big reports and all my hard news stories and a big photo gallery also. I've got a link section so that it has other media sources, websites that cover the situation on the ground real good, as well as some media watchdog groups like Media Lens and Media Channel and FAIR. So that's the website, and then that's the NGO, and the donations are for Mark. He's currently working on a longer documentary like this, but an hour long, and is hoping to get a full-length feature film also. Talking about indie media today here, you know, this is a way to support somebody that's doing really important work, has loads of exclusive footage, and he definitely needs the help. The guy's flat broke because he's put everything that he's got into making this film. So that's that, and we'll go ahead. Are there any other announcements you guys need to make? Otherwise, we can just start taking some questions.
What's the Al-Fasani and the
And I'd like to also know what your read is on the U.S. press that he's getting.
What's my read on Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who is the most powerful religious leader in Iraq? And then the second question is, what do I think about the press he's been getting? I can't answer the first question. I really don't know what kind of press he's been getting in the mainstream over here, because I really haven't followed that. But he's born in Iran, and he moved to Najaf in 1953, and he is the most powerful cleric in Iraq. His political representatives now basically have most of the power in the new government, people like Jafari. So he works very quietly behind the scenes. He's always calling for quiet and calm and peace and reconciliation. But my read on him personally is that he's essentially acting in concert with the wishes of Iran. For example, his political parties, and specifically, or the Dawah party that was also on his coalition list that got the majority of the power in the new Iraqi government, their militia, the Badr organization, is one of the most powerful militias now in the country, and they were trained and armed and funded by Iran. So I think it's a really interesting thing to watch the connections between him and Iran, and how him and his political representatives and their fighters in Iraq are used specifically in regards to what will develop concerning future U.S. policy against Iran. If there is any attack on Iran whatsoever, we would see in Iraq, in my opinion, a resistance that would make this one look like a warm-up. You were next.
Yeah, I was wondering if you have any direct knowledge of what we saw there in the destruction of Fallujah. Is that citywide? Does the whole city look like that? And if so, how have people who have come back there, how are they surviving?
The question is, what is the status of the overall situation of the city of Fallujah as far as how much destruction has taken place, and the people going back, how are they surviving? It's estimated by, there's a couple of different Iraqi human rights organizations now operating in the city, and I've interviewed several of them face-to-face when I was over in Jordan recently, and they say 60% of the city was bombed to the ground. What was left received at least some damage, up to heavy damage. To this day, two districts of the city have no water and no electricity. There's basically no employment in the city. It's very difficult to get anything in and out of the city, as you can imagine, through the Israeli-style checkpoints. There continues to be fighting. Several soldiers were wounded in Fallujah yesterday because they were attacked. Resistance. The military's never had total control of the city, even after doing that to it. They to this day, you know, it's these draconian security measures, but really there's still sporadic fighting either in or around Fallujah almost every single day. What water there is available in the other parts of the city, people are being instructed to boil it. There's lots of disease, because what happens in some of those tents were inside Fallujah, where people will literally go to where their house was and like pitch a tent in the crater, and then hopefully try to start rebuilding themselves. They were promised X amount of funds by I don't know the number off the top of my head. I think it was around $600 million to start rebuilding by the U.S. military. And then when it came time to pay up, they offered them one-fifth that amount. So the people of Fallujah turned it down. They were insulted. So there really hasn't been any assistance from outside. There's not much going on there. People are basically just going back in and trying to survive. And at this point, definitely the majority of people have gone back in the city, but they're describing it as a big jail. And they're just trying to survive. I mean, it's essentially a big kind of refugee camp, bombed out city right now.
Yeah, as far as rebuilding, I mean, do you know anything about what actually is happening with rebuilding, with all the money that's going, that we're paying for through Halliburton, et cetera? I mean, is it just on hold, or is it just going to the top grass and in their pockets, or is there anything at all going on? I mean, what do you know about it? I mean,
Yeah, the question is what's happening with rebuilding and reconstruction in Iraq. And I'll start with talking about a more in-depth report that I did on the water treatment plants, which fell under Bechtel's contract. And I got hired by a watchdog group called, Public Citizen. And I did the report last spring of 04. And I had a copy of Bechtel's contract. And I'm going to just use this as a specific example to show you overall what I see also. And it was really difficult in their contract to find specifics on water treatment plants. It was a really nebulous contract. But I did find, they mentioned Hilla, Najaf, and Diwaniya. And they also mentioned one in Baghdad, but I couldn't get access to it because it was occupied by troops. So I went to Hilla, Najaf, and Diwaniya, and I went to the water treatment plants because it was either past the date where the work was supposed to be completed or almost to that date. And I interviewed the head or assistant engineer at each water treatment plant. In the best case scenario, one of them said, well, some people with Bechtel came by or one of their subcontractors and they replaced our sand filters, but that doesn't, in effect, produce any more potable water. The other two places basically said, Bechtel who? They complained about, if they just give us the material, we are engineers, we can replace the pipes, but they're not being allowed to do that. And what I found in all the areas surrounding these water treatment plants in the cities and the villages that were under their jurisdiction was, like I talked about in this report, rampant cholera, diarrhea, kidney stones, nausea, waterborne diseases. Another example of how it plays out on the ground when these contracts aren't fulfilled is one of these villages was across a highway from a factory, and the factory was giving some water to people in this village, but 8 children had died trying to cross that highway to get water. This is just one example. Bechtel has been paid out in full for their initial contract of $680 million. They've been awarded contracts of $3.8 billion. We're paying for it. We were talking about this earlier some, but $8 billion is missing. And CPA accounting, Coalition Provisional Authority accounting, it's literally, and this is where that's fact. My opinion is, what I see is corporate looting. There's no oversight. Aside from me and a few other people who've looked into it, there really is no control. When I asked the spokesperson for USAID in Baghdad last winter specific information about a company out of Massachusetts that had scored a contract on some of the medical situation there, I wanted specifics. I said, give me the specifics. What have they done? I'll report it whatever. And he said, well, we really here at and USAID is the organization that basically doles out the contracts. And he said, well, we really aren't interested in the specifics. We're really just interested in the finished product. And he wouldn't really give me the information. So it's a disaster. And really, in my opinion, that if they had given half of these contracts out to Iraqis, or at least half of the employees they hired hire Iraqis instead of bringing in these third country nationals, then we wouldn't have much of a resistance because more Iraqis would be benefiting under the occupation. As it is, with corporate greed, Iraqis are screwed. They're fully capable of rebuilding their own country, and they're simply not being allowed to do so. And then they compare it to the fact that even after 91, under the sanctions, under Saddam, with no outside assistance, they had all their water and electricity back up 3 to 6 months after the war. And now here it is well over 2 years, and everything's worse. Water, electricity, oil production, employment, traffic, security, you name it, everything's worse. So in sum, there's next to no reconstruction going on in Iraq. And they say, well, it's because of security or getting supplies or et cetera, et cetera. Well, then why don't you allow Iraqis to do the work? You, and then I'll go to you.
I've heard that hospitals and doctors and ambulances are intentionally targeted to prevent reporting of casualties. What are your thoughts on that?
The question is, are ambulances being intentionally targeted by the military? Yes, I've seen it firsthand. I went into Fallujah during the April siege on April 9th, where the military declared it a ceasefire. So I knew it would be dangerous, but I figured if I was going to go, going during a ceasefire seemed to make the most sense. I went into the city as mushroom clouds were coming out of it, and there was sporadic fighting everywhere, so there was not a ceasefire. And I went into a small clinic, and the one photo of the ambulance with the bullet hole right through the windshield, that was taken at that clinic. That was their one left functioning ambulance, and it was definitely being, all the doctors were telling me they were being targeted by the military, and they had had several ambulances blown up by planes, and what were remaining were definitely being targeted by snipers. And I had actually three colleagues of mine, one an Iraqi, one an American independent filmmaker, and one a British activist, and they all went out in an ambulance to try to exploit their passports, or the two Westerners, in order to get to wounded and dead Iraqis, because when Iraqis went, they were getting killed. So they actually went out, they were trying to pick some people up, they went out on a second run, and their ambulance started getting sniped while they were in it. And then they miraculously got away. But that was pretty much standard operating procedure. Then Paul Bremer was even pressed by the Minister of Health in Iraq at that time to explain this, and Bremer basically offered the definition of collective punishment as his reasoning. He said, well, some ambulances were being used by fighters to move fighters and transport arms, which I don't doubt, so we shoot them all. I mean, that was his excuse. So, and that was definitely the same policy in November. But in November, they took it even to a greater length, where the main hospital was occupied, actually in April as well. But before the siege even began in November, the main hospital was occupied, snipers put on the roof, and then in the first week of that siege, a small clinic and a small hospital in the city were bombed to the ground. And again, I interviewed another doctor even recently. He was in Fallujah in April, and he said that it was so bad for them working there that they had no ambulance, so a team of three doctors went out to try to get an old man who had been shot by snipers. And they were on one side of the road, he was over there, and snipers were shooting down this way. And they had to literally count to three and run across the road with a stretcher, put it down, put him on it, tie a rope to it, and then run back across the road on the count of three. And then when they started pulling him across the road, he was shot. So this is a standard operating procedure, it looks like. And when we look at what happened in Haditha, in Al-Qaim, and the two major military operations there more recently, they go out, they either occupy or attack the hospital. They do it to prevent, I think, to prevent fighters from being treated and helped. But it's horrific. It's unbelievable. If I hadn't gone in there and seen it myself, I think maybe it would be hard to believe. But not only have I seen it firsthand, but I've seen the continuation of it.
Filmmaker is to go in to Fallujah to get in to be able to have the access to tell us the stories. How difficult is it?
Well, I haven't been into Fallujah since May. I went in April. '04. I went in April '04 during the fighting, and it was hard. When I went in, on a bus that was carrying in humanitarian supplies. And we had to still take back roads because all the main ones were cut off by the U.S. forces. And it was very dangerous, but with the right connections, you can get in, and or could then. In November, I don't know of anyone who went in during the siege because the U.S. wasn't letting anyone in. Again, but they were being even more strict about it. And it's a small miracle that my colleague managed to get in. He got in January. And spent about 2 weeks working in and around the city, and he just had to be really creative. Yeah. Thanks. The question is, talk about depleted uranium. And uranium munitions, I'm assuming all of you probably know what they are, but they're basically a low-grade nuclear weapon. It's a metal that they use in some of the bullets and tank shells and sometimes missiles because it's very, very dense and it will go through armor, it will go through several walls. I mean, it's like having a super bullet. You can shoot through just about anything. And it was used, well, I should say that it is definitely radioactive and it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. And at least 800 tons were used during the 91 Gulf War, and I've seen estimates of 400, 600, and sometimes even more than that during the current war, and it's still being used. It's been used very heavily in Fallujah. It's been used very heavily in Baghdad. Basically, anywhere where there's a major military operation, you can rest assured that uranium munitions are being used. To give you an idea of some of the effects, starting with the 91 Gulf War and U.S. soldiers, just from the 91 Gulf War, it's estimated that at least 11,000 U.S. soldiers who have returned from that war are dead because of the exposure to uranium munitions. Other reports of these soldiers are that they're coming home, their wives get pregnant, and they give birth to babies with horrible deformities or no spines or no brains. And then amongst, and keeping in mind the 91 Gulf War, I think soldiers were in Iraq not more than about 3 months. And then as far as how that affected Iraqis from that time forward, Dr. Thomas Fauci testified at the World Tribunal, and he's an American scientist who studied DU quite a bit, and he said he cited one survey that showed that in Basra, in southern Iraq, from 1990 to 2002, for Iraqi children 1 to 5 years old, that the rate of childhood leukemia rose 26-fold in those 12 years, and that's just in the Basra area. And then with the current situation, I know that from the mid to late 90s, cancer rates over kind of just a little bit north of Basra, but still south of Baghdad, cancer rates rose at least 400%. Now in Baghdad, it's really hard to find anyone that either their wife has had breast. It's hard to find anyone who their wife has not had breast cancer or who has had a miscarriage, which is a definite symptom of exposure to radiation, or at least has a relative or a friend that's happened to. And recent reports have Iraqi doctors discussing that cancer rates are going through the roof, cancer medication is in short supply, and birth defects are through the roof. And this is already happening in Fallujah just after the April siege. There's a lot of new birth defects, and babies are being born without eyes there as well as down in the south too. I think it's the biggest and most underreported story in the whole thing, with its effect on Iraqis especially, but now with U.S. soldiers, you know, I mean, compare the 91 Gulf War, troops on the ground for three months maximum, now they've been over there for well over 2 years.
So until we stop supplying fodder for the military, this will continue.
Yeah. Is there any data on returning American soldiers with uranium problems?
Is there any data on returning American soldiers from this war?
Yes.
I know the same, I've read reports of the same things happening as far as them coming back and having similar symptoms after 91. Already, definitely people are going home sick with similar symptoms of what happened after 91. It's an area, beyond that, I don't have more information. But on that note, I do want to talk about that. Yesterday in the Wall Street Journal even, I saw a little quote, and I'll read it. The Army Surgeon General said a survey of troops returning from Iraq found 30% had developed mental health problems within 3 to 4 months. And there's the number of U.S. troops killed. It's almost 1,800 now. But that doesn't include the number of troops killed who are evacuated out of the country. So if they get them to Germany and then they die, that's not in that 1,800. And so it's estimated the number is 2 to 3 times higher than 1,800, possibly even more than that. And then what also doesn't get reported very often is wounded. And when we talk about wounded, we talk about maimed, disabled for life, and the most common injury for troops now coming out of Iraq, aside from mental injury, is they go by a roadside bomb, and maybe it doesn't quite hit their Humvee and they don't have any physical damage, but the concussion, because the bombs they're using now are so big that the resistance is using. The concussion is great enough that it's, I've seen photos of where it's blown a soldier's helmet off, but his chin strap's still on. And so it's the same theory of don't shake a baby, that like it's so great that physically they'll be okay, they'll be unscathed, but they basically will have brain damage for the rest of their life. And that's actually the leading injury now behind mental problems coming out of Iraq. And there's at least 25,000 wounded soldiers. Right now we're averaging between 2 and 3 soldiers a day being killed and 10 times that number wounded. And again, we don't really see this because corporate media, if we remember the big scandal that broke out showing the cargo plane full of coffins of U.S. soldiers with flags over them, big scandal, so we haven't seen it since. And TV doesn't show this. Again, it's really, they learned their lessons from Vietnam really well. And we're not having a draft, and we're not seeing this stuff on TV, and that's why we really don't have near the outcry yet that we had in Vietnam.
Have you had any reaction at all from corporate media to your reporting?
Have I had any reaction at all from corporate media to my reporting? Not really. One story, just to give you an example, I was idealistic and naive enough when I first went over to Iraq to believe that if they had the right information, they would report it. And so I did this Sadiq Zoman story. I wrote this up in January 04. The Abu Ghraib scandal broke in late April 04. And I had a friend help me write this up, and we sent it out to major newspapers, and no one even replied. And it wasn't about getting my name out or money. It was like, oh, just, you know, here, maybe you should cover this. And no one replied. But a lot of other independent journalists were reporting on torture for even before that, and none of it was being picked up. There's huge censorship going on. And I've been, as far as other major media, I mean, I was invited on the Geraldo show on Fox after April, because I'd come out of Fallujah and I wrote a piece for the Nation's website called Sarajevo on the Euphrates, talking about the sniping of civilians that was going on there. And it raised a lot of controversy, and people didn't want to hear about that. And they invited me on the show, and they wanted me to come into their Baghdad bureau. And that I figured they just wanted to try to discredit me. And I was really, really inexperienced still at the time. And I would go now, but at the time I was like, you know, I'm not up for that. What's the point? You know, the information speaks for itself. But no, overall, I think they consistently ignore any story that, for example, the Bush administration or the Pentagon wouldn't want to get out there.
You've been listening to An Evening with Dar Jamal, keynote speaker at the People as the Media Grassroots Independent Media Conference, Palomar College, San Marcos, California, on July 30, 2005. Recorded for independent media by upstartradio.com. This is a tape change. The question asked was, what about Hollywood?
They are making a movie in Hollywood now starring Harrison Ford called The Battle for Fallujah. So we got to get this stuff out because it's not going to talk about this. I mean, just for example, talking about the mainstream media and talking about NPR, which supposedly used to be quasi-objective. They recently had an interview with a reporter who embedded with the military in Fallujah in November. And they did a whole hour, and they went through the whole interview, and he talked about military strategies being used by the resistance, what the U.S. did to counter that, et cetera, et cetera. Not once did he talk about civilian casualties. Not once did he talk about refugees or any of the stuff that you saw tonight. NPR, National Pentagon Radio. So you can imagine what this film will be. But I think, again, you know, here we are. We had this independent media conference today, grassroots media, and really it's imperative that we get this information out. And these films, there's a lot of films already out there, but again, we have to show them on the popular level and not rely on the mainstream, because they're just not going to do it. This film that you just saw it went up to the executive level for the major networks because he was going to try to get it shown on national TV, and they said it was too one-sided.
What is the title of this film?
Caught in the Crossfire.
Could I ask two questions? One is, since the second attack on Fallujah, I've heard that there are only four entrance and exit from Fallujah. Is that true? The other one is, like, decipher some of the what's going on in the mainstream corporate media, and that is, if we leave Iraq right now, the occupation forces get out, there would be civil war, the Sunnis will kill the Shia will kill the Kurdish, and the Kurdish will kill this and that. What is your take on that, please?
First question is, he heard that there's four exits and entries into Fallujah, and I think that's correct, and they're checkpoints like you've seen. They're draconian checkpoints. You have to be retina scanned and fingerprinted and get an ID card to get in. They try to keep people in. They're oftentimes don't let people leave at all. And if you try to go in an area not in one of those checkpoints, you'll be shot. And that's why the people in the city describe it as a big jail. And as far as the media, the corporate media portraying bedlam and anarchy and barbarism in Iraq if the U.S. pulls out, as if the savage Arab beasts will eat themselves without the great white hope being there, I think it's extremely racist and ignorant, considering the fact Iraq, Babylon, is a place where law began. It's a place where much of our science began, so much of our art, and is in so many ways the cradle of civilization. And it's really a ridiculous thing to think that a civil war is going to break out if the U.S. pulls out, for a couple of reasons. One, because we already have state-sponsored civil war. We have a U.S.-backed Iraqi government who has officially sanctioned the two biggest militias in the country, the Badr organization, which are Shia, and the Kurdish Peshmerga militia, to fight a primarily Sunni resistance movement. So we have state-sponsored civil war going on right now, and the big concern is, will it spread? But I should talk about Shia and Sunni for a bit, because I've looked into this a lot, because there's been so much rhetoric, well, they're going to eat each other, the Shia and Sunni hate each other. There's never been a war between the Shia and the Sunni. The media has taken, for example, the Shia uprising in 91 that was going to be backed by Bush, and then he basically left them out cold to be put down by Saddam. That's been portrayed as this Shia versus Sunni fight, and it's not. It's a Shia versus Saddam Hussein regime fight. There's never, I mean, a lot of the tribes in Iraq are both Shia and Sunni. There's thousands, tens of thousands of marriages that are Shia and Sunni. I actually, up in Sacramento, I had dinner with a bunch of Iraqis, and they said, you know, growing up, I had friends I never even knew if they were Sunni or Shia. We never asked. We've never known this 60-40 Shia-Sunni thing. We don't know what this is. We don't know where these came from. I interviewed a man who worked for the former regime. He's a Christian, and he worked for them 15 years in their statistics department. And he said that there has never, ever been in Iraq a survey trying to determine how many Shia there are and how many Sunni. Even on the food ration cards, the monthly food for oil for food program, the food rations are still in existence. And even on those cards, you have to specify your religion, but it doesn't have Islam, and then tick whether you're Sunni or Shia. So much of this is the divide and conquer rhetoric. It's a State Department policy. We've seen them enact this in so many other places in the past, and in other wars and coups that they've taken place in. And it certainly behooves them to have a civil war so that the Iraqis would fight one another as opposed to fighting them. But I should also then point out that there's a huge political resistance movement now in Iraq. Just recently, Muqtada al-Sadr managed to get a petition with over 1 million signatures on it. And if, you know, Iraq has 1/10 the number of people there in the U.S., so that would be the equivalent of having a petition of 10 million people here. I mean, the After Downing Street memo didn't even get that many. And so 10 million people, or in Iraq, it's 1 million people demanding an immediate end to the occupation. We have at least 103 ministers of parliament in the new puppet government, even, that are calling for an immediate withdrawal. So there's a huge political pressure. There's the Foundation Congress, which is a coalition of 30 political parties, Sunni, Shia, Kurdish, Christian, set up now demanding new, real on U.S. tampered elections. So all of that is in place and in happening. So if the U.S. were to pull out, we'd have the leading cause of violence and instability gone, and then Iraqis would have a really good shot at having sovereignty.
Did you say U.S. tampered elections?
Never. Never. No, no.
You don't have the answer you don't want to, but
I'm wondering,
best of your estimate, how many people in the United States has read your article and how many all over the world?
How many people in the States or elsewhere have read my articles? This is actually a good news story that, even though it's been largely ignored by the mainstream media, there were times last winter, because I was the only American independent journalist in Iraq in November and the first part of December, and was reporting very heavily on Fallujah and what else was happening. And there were times during that time where my site was getting 1 million hits a day. So it's been a lot. And in fact, I've gotten published in other bigger outlets in other countries like the Sunday Herald in Scotland and the Guardian in the UK and Irish Public Radio and things like this. So it's kind of ironic that I went there to try to get information back to the American people, but thanks to the internet, I think that's happened, and you know, grassroots movements in radio and independent media. But it's getting out there, and I think now we're starting to see the effects of that. I mean, people back home now, I think, are really starting to get it, that this is a really bad situation. It's bad for the country. It's horrible for Iraq. And what is the plan? There is no plan. Why won't they call for it? I think people, even more people that rely on the mainstream, are starting to kind of get this.
You know, after seeing that film, I can't tell you how angry and how guilty I feel. Yes. We're sitting in this beautiful air-conditioned room in probably one of the most beautiful parts of the United States of America. You know, we're going to get into our SUVs and go back home. And open up.
Stop right there.
Don't dwell on.
Okay, we're going to get in our Volkswagens and go back.
One more outburst like that.
At any rate, the point is, you know, we're going to get home safely. We're going to be in comfort. We're going to go home and be in comfort. We're going to go in the refrigerator and we're going to get the milk or the orange juice or the water or whatever it is that we want. And it's a likely possibility that the electricity will actually have been on the entire time we were gone. And I looked at the bombed out city, and I am so furious that our government, who was not elected, but yet appointed.
I didn't know her name.
Pardon me?
Yeah,
in our name, you know, we as American citizens are taking basically the hit for this person who's directing all of this, and we can't get anybody to even know that it's going on. I commend you for what you're doing.
Thanks, and I understand that frustration all too well, believe me. Sometimes it is really hard just to be in the country, and it's just good to see, though. I mean, I'm going around giving presentations, and the crowds are getting bigger and bigger, and people are getting more and more angry, and people are getting it, you know, and I really do see that there is momentum going, and yeah, this has to stop, because I believe that if there isn't a drastic, 180-degree change in U.S. policy in Iraq really soon, Iraq will be to the United States what Afghanistan was to the Soviet Union. I mean, it's bleeding this country. Over $1 billion a week just to be there. The country's in over $7 trillion of debt. And look at the Bush defense budget for 2006. Okay, we're over $7 trillion in debt, and it's $674 billion. not including Iraq and Afghanistan.
And we had to fight to get an extra $1.5 billion for veterans health care.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Because the Secretary of Defense lied, and the VA Secretary lied, and says, oh, no, we don't have a funding problem for health care for veterans. Bullshit.
I'm going to take two more, and then my brain cells are pretty much done.
You stated you're an American citizen. I'm just curious, obviously your name isn't Americanized, and I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of your background and what exactly drove you to go into Iraq, because it's just extraordinary, to say the least.
Well, she said I was crazy. I mean, that's... Yeah. Yeah, he asked, like, what's the origins of my name and what's a little bit of my background and took me to Iraq. And I have an Arabic name because my great-grandparents on my father's side are Lebanese Christians. I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, and I went to school at Texas A&M. And then things changed. I moved out of Texas. Seriously, and then things really started to change. I saw that, people actually had other opinions, thought about things a little bit differently than so many people in Texas. But I was living in Alaska. I started to wake up politically in 99. The 2000 coup here kind of sped that along a bit, and I started freelancing. And then after 9/11, I just was... started to watch the media, you know, kind of getting the whole manufacturing consent thing that was going on. And then after the reaction to Afghanistan and during the build-up to the invasion of Iraq, immediately just seeing this BS being spewed and unquestioned, and I figured, you know, it's a media thing, and you know, what can I do to try to change it? And it was really kind of an act of desperation. I mean, I was really pissed, and I was tired of feeling impotent politically, like going to demonstrations and writing letters and seeing nothing happen. And I felt that it's time, you know, that like it's go time. I mean, it's just time to do something drastic. And so I'm, you know, I'm not married, don't have kids, didn't have debt, decided I'd save money. And I like to write. I'll go to Iraq and I'll write, and that'll be my drop in the bucket. And I kind of intended it to be a one-trip deal. And I thought, well, I'll just go. This will be my little action, my protest, and I'll maybe wake a few people up. And it's gone a little bit further than that. But I do say, and is that really, I think that time, and I used to close my presentations by saying, you know, we are at a point where I think that whatever that next thing is that all of us have thought about doing, but haven't done because it's too risky or afraid or whatever, I think the time to do that is right now. That we're at that point in this country.
Surrounding the White House nonstop, like we've done in Ukraine, Ukraine and what was the other place? You know, they had the orange, the rose revolution.
Going to Ukraine.
Yeah, Ukraine.
Go for it.
I'm seeing Mark Manning in 2 days. I will tell him this is from you.
Don't buy any ice cream with us.
I won't.
You've been listening to An Evening with Dar Jamal, keynote speaker at the People as the Media Grassroots Independent Media Conference, Palomar College, San Marcos, California, on July 30, 2005. Recorded for independent media by UpstartRadio.com.